The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the June 26th, 2020 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows three young people in the foreground of what looks like a crowded bar scene. It's two guys and a gal. Two of them have masks, but they're down below their chins, and they're laughing like somebody just said something funny. And the one guy, he's got a baseball hat, his head is kicked back, and his mouth is wide open, and it shows a spray of just hundreds of little coronavirus balls flying out into the air. The headline is, "Sick and Tired. COVID cases surge as pandemic fatigue drives high-risk behavior." And that is our first main story. We'll start right there. A COVID surge in many reopened states. What happened? More than a month after states began broad reversals of lockdown measures, many in the South and West faced rising coronavirus infection numbers this week, with some hitting record daily totals. As of last weekend, new case numbers were climbing in 22 states. Arizona, Florida, Texas, Alabama, and North Carolina were among those reporting record spikes in new cases, with Florida hitting 2,783 new cases Tuesday, and Arizona posting a 54% increase between the last week of May and the first week of June. 10 states have hit record single-day totals for hospitalizations. In Texas, the record was broken 8 times in 9 days, and the top county executive in Houston warned of looming disaster. Public health experts said the cause was clear, citing quarantine fatigue and return to salons, gyms, bars, and restaurants by people who aren't distancing or wearing masks. Some previously packed bars have closed in Texas, Arizona, and Florida, where a 40-year-old healthcare worker, Erica Crisp, reported that a single night out at a Jacksonville bar led to her and 15 friends testing positive for the coronavirus. "We were careless," said Crisp, who's been sick for more than a week. "It was too soon." Amid the infection spikes, public health officials urged residents to observe safe practices, including wearing masks and avoiding crowds, especially indoors. But they faced broad resistance from citizens and Republican officials, and in many cases, threats and lawsuits. "I think people are tired," said Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson, about the lack of safety observance. "I'm very concerned about it." The White House's coronavirus task force now meets only once or twice a week and has not given a public briefing since April 27th. Vice President Mike Pence, the task force leader, said that reports of a surge of new cases were overblown and asserted we are winning the fight. Meanwhile, President Trump pushed ahead with plans to hold a campaign rally inside a packed enclosed arena in Tulsa over the panicked objections of local officials who fear it could become a super spreader event. "It's a perfect storm that we can't afford to have," said Tulsa Health Department Director Bruce Dart. What the editorial said: "Sad to say, we can't take a vacation from the virus," said the Philadelphia Inquirer. "While many are understandably eager to resume normal lives, we still face a dangerous disease that's killed more than 120,000 Americans and sickened 2.2 million more. It's too soon to allow economic and political pressures to overwhelm our defenses. Too many people have taken the lifting of restrictions as an all clear, said the Houston Chronicle. It's put us at a tipping point from which we as a nation must pull back. There's a way forward without returning to lockdowns, but it requires renewed vigilance. Headlines trumpeting a resurgence are overblown, said the Wall Street Journal. Many new infections are connected to prisons and meatpacking plants, and hospitals have not been overwhelmed. Yes, more infections are inevitable as states reopen, and there will be much trial and error. But move forward, we must. The cost of shutting down are so great that there is no alternative. What the colonists said. Is Trump trying to spread COVID-19? Asked Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. There's now clear data from other countries and from scientists about how to reduce viral infection. That includes wearing masks and avoiding crowded indoor spaces. Yet we have a president who's turned shunning masks into a heroic act of defiance against liberals and plans a mass indoor rally in a city with climbing cases. It's perverse. America is entering a complicated new phase of the pandemic, said Scott Gottlieb and Yuval Levin in the Wall Street Journal. Instead of a binary choice between lockdowns and total freedom, this phase calls for vigilant flexibility as states and cities adapt to shifting circumstances. Public officials should strongly encourage masks and distancing as the economy tentatively reopens, and when hotspots arise, they should trace the origins and be ready to curtail specific activities. We need to focus on building public confidence and instilling the patience to get through what could be a hard fall and winter. We're snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, said Yasha Monk in TheAtlantic.com. Even as the case numbers spike, the disease is slowly starting to recede from the public's attention. With public opinion increasingly polarized, any renewed attempt to combat the virus is likely to be even more haphazard, contentious, and ineffective than it was the first time around. Thanks to the efforts of millions to stay home and prevent viral spread, we were close to a historic success story. Instead, we seem ready to give up and tolerate that hundreds of thousands of our fellow citizens will die needless deaths. And we'll go to a second main story. Push for police reform takes center stage. What happened? Protests against racial injustice and police brutality continued across the nation this week, a movement that gained further momentum after a black man was shot dead as he fled police in Atlanta. Rayshard Brooks, 27, was confronted by two police officers after he fell asleep in his car while waiting in a Wendy's drive-through line. Brooks failed a sobriety test and began to scuffle with the officers when they tried to handcuff him, according to footage of the incident. Brooks emerged from the melee with an officer's taser and fired it wildly as he ran away. Officer Garrett Rolfe then shot Brooks twice in the back with a handgun. The killing triggered new waves of protest in Atlanta and led the city's police chief, Erica Shields, to announce her resignation. Rolfe was fired and charged with felony murder. Police must be guardians and not warriors within our communities, said Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms. In a bid to address the growing outcry over such killings, President Trump signed an executive order on police reform. Among other measures, it directs the Justice Department to create a national database of officers with a history of misconduct and offers incentives to police departments that mandate de-escalation training. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called the executive order weak. House Democrats have introduced a sweeping bill that would ban chokeholds, limit qualified immunity for police officers, and stop the use of no-knock warrants in drug cases. Senate Republicans, meanwhile, offered a bill that would withhold federal funding from police departments that fail to phase out practices such as chokeholds. What the editorials said. Every story is different, and yet every story is the same, said the Washington Post. Eric Garner was choked to death by a New York City police officer in 2014 for the crime of selling cigarettes on the streets. George Floyd was suffocated in Minneapolis for passing a possibly phony $20 bill. Now Brooks is dead for sleeping it off in a Wendy's drive-thru. None of these black men posed a threat to police, yet all died because of officers who came readier to attack than to understand. Reform won't happen until we change how police contracts are negotiated, said the Wall Street Journal. Collective bargaining in business is adversarial, but elected officials often rely on public unions for votes, and disciplinary protections are easy to give away in contract talks. In Minneapolis, for example, it's now all but impossible for the city to fire rogue officers. Of the 2,600 misconduct complaints there since 2012, only 12 ended with discipline. The most severe punishment was a 40-hour suspension. What the columnist said. We are witnessing a great awakening, said Van Jones in CNN.com. I've spent my entire life trying to persuade relatively small groups of white people to take racial injustice seriously. I have usually failed. But footage of the killings of Floyd, Brooks, and other African Americans has shown whites that anti-black racism is a real and present danger. And an unprecedented number have joined multiracial Black Lives Matter marches across the country. It feels like a miracle. Trump keeps blaming a few bad apples for police brutality, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. But the evidence shows that racism has infected the entire law enforcement system. Consider that black men are about 2.5 times more likely than white men to be killed by police and are arrested at twice the rate as whites for disorderly conduct, drug possession, and other petty charges. A recent study of nearly 100 million traffic stops nationwide found that black drivers are pulled over far more frequently than white drivers. The difference becomes smaller at night when it's harder for officers to tell the race of the driver. Coincidence? I think not. The battle on Capitol Hill over police reform will likely turn on qualified immunity, said Crystal Hayes in USA Today. Republicans have declared that revising the almost blanket legal protection afforded to officers against civil suits for actions taken on the job is a non-starter. Democrats have also dug in their heels, insisting that qualified immunity must end. With an election coming and both parties eager to secure a win for their bases, there might be no satisfactory middle ground on federal police reform. Our controversy of the week is titled, Successor Ideology. Is free speech obsolete? Has the woke left killed classical liberalism? Asks Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. The intolerant mindset about safe spaces and free speech once found on college campuses has migrated to the culture as a whole. And it's grown more adamant amid the racial awakening following George Floyd's killing by police. At private companies and politics, and at newspapers and websites, young progressives are demanding the firing, blacklisting, and or censoring of anyone they deem insufficiently anti-racist. It's not only prominent older editors like James Bennett of the New York Times who are having their careers destroyed. In Bennett's case, because his op-ed section ran an arguably offensive opinion column about the protest by Republican Senator Tom Cotton. Consider the case of Li Fang, a leftist reporter for the leftist TheIntercept.com. After sharing his interview with a black protester who expressed concern about non-police violence in his community, Fang was publicly accused of anti-blackness and kept his job only after writing a lengthy groveling apology for his insensitivity. We used to call this phenomenon political correctness or identity politics, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. But the revolutionary belief that journalism and all institutions should be governed by a singular, virtuous, anti-racist truth has evolved into what cultural critic Wesley Yang has called the successor ideology to liberalism itself. It is taking hold everywhere from the Ivy League to the publishing industry to HR departments all over corporate America. Centrist pundits are upset, said Jeet here in thenation.com, because they still conceive of American public discourse as a genteel debate club where competing visions of society do healthy battle in the marketplace of ideas. But when the real-world consequences of systemic racism mean getting beat up or killed by militarized cops, you understandably have less patience for the cherished liberal notion that all points of view deserve an airing. If liberalism is dead, Donald Trump killed it, said Jay Rosen in PressThink.org. When a president wages all-out war on the free press, science, every institution checking his power, and truth itself, the belief that good speech drives out bad speech is an expensive illusion to maintain. If this madness is all a reaction to Trump, said Rolling Stone contributor Max Tabby in his newsletter, then why are the Twitter Robespierres of the woke left so focused on persecuting heretics in their own ranks? David Shore, a 28-year-old Democratic data analyst who once worked on President Obama's reelection campaign, was recently fired for tweeting a link to research suggesting that violent protest risk a political backlash. Critics said that tweet reeks of anti-blackness. This inflexible orthodoxy is closer to cult religion than politics and has institutions from the New York Times to the Democratic leadership in Congress kneeling in supplication and fear. It's not just the left, said David French in the dispatch.com. The climate of fear now gripping liberal newsrooms has a perfect analog in conservative media and Republican politics, where any criticism of President Trump will earn you death threats, vile insults from a Twitter mob, and expulsion. America was founded on the classical liberal values of pluralism and free speech, said Andrew Sullivan in nymag.com. But we should not forget that this is also the country of the Scarlet Letter and Prohibition and the Hollywood Blacklist. The totalitarian mindset that wants to punish even respectful disagreement is chillingly recognizable in American history and increasingly in the American present. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for reading the fine print after the registration page for President Trump's rally in Tulsa warned that you and any guest voluntarily assume all risks related to exposure to COVID-19. It was a good week for extreme measures after Russian President Vladimir Putin reportedly installed a disinfection tunnel in his official residence that bathes all visitors with a fine mist from head to toe. And it was a good week for even more extreme measures, with updated advice from the New York City Health Department on having sex in the age of COVID-19. Officials recommended that single people be creative with physical barriers like walls that allow sexual contact while preventing close face-to-face contact. Meanwhile, it was a bad week for stereotypes after Quaker Oats announced it would rebrand its Aunt Jemima pancake and syrup products, whose name and imagery is based on a 19th century minstrel show song about a black mammy who took care of white families' children. It was a bad week for the bald, who are much more likely to develop serious symptoms of COVID-19, according to new research from Brown University. Citing data from Spain, where 80% of COVID patients at one Madrid hospital had little or no hair, Professor Carlos Wambler called baldness a perfect predictor of severity. Finally, it was a bad week for incursions, with the news that Poland accidentally invaded the Czech Republic last month as heavily armed Polish troops occupied a chapel some 33 yards inside Czech territory for several days. The incursion was a result of a misunderstanding, not a deliberate act, said Poland's defense ministry. It was corrected immediately. And a short news piece before we move on. FDA pulls approval of Trump back drugged. The Food and Drug Administration rescinded its emergency use authorization for hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine to treat hospitalized COVID-19 patients this week, saying that it was no longer reasonable to believe the drugs were effective against the coronavirus. The authorization for the drugs, typically prescribed to treat malaria and autoimmune conditions like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, was issued in March after President Trump called hydroxychloroquine a game changer, saying, "What the hell do you have to lose?" Sales soared, yet studies found some COVID-19 patients given hydroxychloroquine developed serious heart disorders. Trump, who took the drug for himself for 2 weeks, reaffirmed his endorsement this week, saying, "It certainly didn't hurt me." On the briefing page, the nursing home disaster. Over 40% of U.S. coronavirus deaths have been linked to long-term care facilities. Why? How bad were the outbreaks? More than 43,000 people and at least 400 workers perished of COVID-19 in nursing home and long-term care facilities. The first outbreak, which essentially launched the pandemic in the U.S., came in February at the Seattle Area Life Care Nursing Facility, where two-thirds of the residents and 47 workers were infected and 37 ultimately died. As other outbreaks exploded, the Centers for Disease Control locked nursing homes down in March, and family members described the horror of being unable to reach their loved ones, in some cases only learning of a parent's illness after the patient died, surrounded by strangers in an ad hoc sick ward. Ghastly stories surfaced. At a New Jersey facility, 68 people died and 17 corpses were piled up in a morgue designed to hold four. At the Soldiers' Home in Holyoke, Massachusetts, a veteran's home, at least 74 died, and the National Guard was called in to relieve the superintendent. Nationwide, overwhelmed workers, typically low and minimum wage, quit en masse, prompting staffing shortages. Many homes failed to alert families and public officials of outbreaks, possibly out of fear of fines or inspections. Why was it so bad? For a highly infectious virus like the new coronavirus, nursing homes were like dry tinder in a wildfire. Mortality rates for COVID-19 rise dramatically for those over 70, especially if they have pre-existing conditions such as heart disease. Moreover, nursing facilities are often cramped, with multiple residents sharing a room, bathroom, and other common areas, perfect conditions for viral spread. Aides, who often work at multiple facilities, move from room to room to provide basic hands-on care, such as washing and repositioning of frail patients. Low medical payments, said Harvard Medical School Professor David Grabowski, really compromised the ability of nursing homes to implement strong staffing and infection control practices. About 65% of patients pay using Medicaid. The federal government said recently that 82% of the nearly 13,300 nursing homes it inspected from 2013 to 2017 were cited for at least one deficiency in infection prevention and control. Even in May, federal inspectors who visited 6,000 facilities found sporadic noncompliance with CDC rules for limiting infection, including staffers not washing their hands or observing strict isolation for the ill. Were the homes at fault? Outbreaks were inevitable, but the industry has not complied with regulations that could have reduced the scale of the disaster. In 2016, the Obama administration introduced new regulations requiring nursing facilities to train staff on dealing with the arrival of a novel and contagious virus. Although the all-hazards rule did not mandate the stockpiling of personal protective equipment, or PPE, homes were required to create staffing contingency plans, as well as plans for evacuating residents, sheltering in place, and getting residents food, medicine, and water during the crisis. The industry heavily lobbied against the rules, describing them as extremely burdensome, in a letter to then newly elected President Trump. From November 2017, when the rule went into effect, to March 2020, inspectors logged more than 24,000 deficiencies in emergency plans at 6,599 nursing facilities, according to an analysis in ProPublica.com. It's just a river of grief, and it could have been prevented, said Pat McGinnis, executive director of California Advocates for Nursing Home Reform. What role did government play? The industry claims that even as the death toll mounted, its pleas for PPE and tests were never met. As a result, many facilities experienced lethal shortages of PPE. In the suburbs of Baltimore, one home's worker said they were given rain ponchos to protect them from infection. In East Los Angeles, a staffer said she was given swimming goggles. In New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo ordered nursing homes to accept recovering coronavirus patients from hospitals, and the Associated Press found 4,500 returned before the directive was repealed on May 10th. The state suffered 5,800 nursing home deaths, more than any other. Cuomo later said he was told to send the recovering COVID patients to nursing homes by the CDC and White House. What's being done now? On April 30th, President Trump vowed to deploy every tool, resource, and power to protect elderly Americans. In mid-May, the administration said it wanted all residents and staff tested over the ensuing 2 weeks. But by the end of May, more than 3,200 facilities said they still had less than a week's supply of PPE and sanitizer, and that some PPE they'd received was defective. State and federal officials had still not provided adequate testing, Vox.com reported. They have not put real dollars behind it, Grabowski said. For Brenda Anagnos, whose 81-year-old mother, Carol Ballard, died at the Kimberly Hall North facility in Windsor, Connecticut, the pain is hard to reconcile. She had life left, Anagnos said of the grandmother of four. She didn't deserve to die like this. And we'll move right into the columns, starting with the coming election debacle. The voting chaos that accompanied Georgia's recent primary is a microcosm of what America may face in November, said Paul Waldman and Greg Sargent. Voters waited for hours in long snaking lines at polling locations, short-staffed because of the pandemic, as new touchscreen voting machines malfunctioned. Meanwhile, many voters who'd requested mail-in ballots said they never arrived. There is widespread potential for similar problems on November 3rd, and with the unpredictability of coronavirus thrown into the mix, the risk of mass voter disenfranchisement looms large. The pattern is always the same. Voters in wealthier and wider neighborhoods experiencing few, if any, problems voting quickly and easily, while those in poorer and more heavily minority neighborhoods wait for hours. If a coronavirus second wave leads to millions more votes cast by mail in November, the problems will be compounded, with delayed results and large numbers of disqualified ballots that may spark lawsuits. If President Trump loses, he will seize on those difficulties to challenge the outcomes. A divisive campaign Russia will amplify through its manipulation of Facebook and other social media. You thought Florida 2000 was chaos? Just wait. Does Trump have a health problem? One of President Trump's main lines of attack against Democrat Joe Biden is that, quote, Sleepy Joe is, quote, weak and shot, said Chris Saliza. That's why Trump's bizarre behavior at his commencement speech at West Point last week was so damaging. While standing on the dais, Trump, 74, struggled to get a glass of water to his lips with his right hand, bringing it in his left to push it up further. Later, the president gingerly walked down a ramp, one small step at a time, while the academy superintendent easily descended alongside him. Trump later tweeted that the ramp was very long and steep and very slippery, and that he didn't want to fall in front of the fake news. Still, his frail behavior raised questions about his health, particularly since we know less about Trump's medical history than any previous modern-day presidents. A doctor has said Trump dictated his 2016 medical report to him, and this year's brief, cursory report on Trump's annual physical did not mention his unscheduled visit to Walter Reed Hospital last year. Trump dismisses Biden as old and feeble. He doesn't know he's alive. So it's absolutely fair game to ask question about Trump's own well-being. This is an international column from South Korea. An explosive message from the North. In the biggest affront to South Korea in years, North Korea has blown up an inter-Korean liaison office on its side of the border, said Shim Kyu-suk. We can't say we weren't warned. The demolition came 3 days after Kim Yo-jong, North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un's sister and advisor, thundered that Seoul would soon see the useless office completely collapsed. The joint facility, a de facto embassy where officials from both countries could talk, was opened in the city of Kaesong in 2018, following a series of promising North-South meetings. Seoul spent some $8 million to renovate the building, closed since January because of the pandemic, and covered its running costs. State-run media in the North said the office was destroyed to meet the expectations of an angry public demanding punishment for riffraff, a reference to South Korean activist who launched hydrogen balloons carrying propaganda leaflets across the border earlier this month. Why the sudden ire? Asked Chusum Ilbo in an editorial. Propaganda balloons have been floating across the border since time began. It's worth noting that Kim Jong-un recently took the unprecedented step of mentioning the pressing issue of how to guarantee Pyongyang residents' livelihood at a Politburo meeting. This suggests U.S. and international sanctions on North Korea, combined with the shutdown of cross-border trade with China to stem the spread of coronavirus, have made living conditions so miserable for the elite that a diversion is urgently needed to quell possible unrest. The kerfuffle in Kaesong could also be a masked overture to the South Korean government, a crass attempt to begin a dialogue that would then allow Kim to milk Seoul for aid. Remember, the North often screams or fires missiles when it just wants to say hello. The demolition occurred at a highly symbolic moment, said Yongsik Kim in the Dong-ah Ilbo. 20 years and one day earlier, the leaders of North and South signed the first ever treaty between their two nations, agreeing to work for peace on our divided peninsula. South Korean President Moon Jae-in marked the 20th anniversary of the accord with a video message in which he urged Pyongyang to pursue talks and said he would try to persuade the U.S. to ease its sanctions. The North responded by exploding the liaison office. Yet Kim's displays of sound and fury aren't aimed really at Seoul, but rather at U.S. President Donald Trump and an administration that has lost interest in North Korea. Even if Pyongyang is merely throwing a tantrum, appeasement is not the answer, said the Jung Il-bo. The rhetoric from North is downright hostile, with state media insulting President Moon as a yellow dog and an SOB. What is our government afraid of? In 2010, when the North shelled out Yeonpyeong Island, we hit back harder, and they pleaded for the resumption of inter-Korean exchanges 2 months later. Kim understands only force. Let's show him some. It's time for the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, What Police Reform Looks Like. Camden, New Jersey took apart its police department and started from scratch, said Catherine Landergren in Politico.com. The rebuilt police force is more accountable, more tied to the community, and more effective. It was the moment that America needed. Days after George Floyd died in the hands of police officers in Minneapolis, a different scene was playing out in what was once the most dangerous city in the United States. Joseph D. Wysocki was marching in the streets of Camden alongside residents in Black Lives Matter t-shirts. He found the organizer of the protest, Yolanda Deaver. Wysocki introduced himself and asked whether he could join her. Absolutely, she said, and the two started marching together, holding up a sign reading, Standing in Solidarity. And then they posed for a now viral photo. I'd seen her do the peace symbol, you know, it's not something I ever do, but I really thought it was appropriate, he said. I think everybody wanted peace. Wysocki wasn't just any 50-year-old white man. He was chief of the Camden Police. And as protests erupted across the country, this moment, Wysocki and the protester with her banner, peace signs, and clenched fist held high, gave America reason to think its widening social fractures could really be healed. As a movement grows in American cities and suburbs to overhaul police departments and confront their long records of racially unjust, violent enforcement, Camden is one rare and complicated success story. A city that really did manage to overhaul its police force and change how it operated. And it took a move as radical and controversial as what some activists are calling for today. Camden really did abolish its police department. Then the city set about rebuilding the police force as an entirely new one under county control, using the opportunity to increase the number of cops on the streets and push through a number of now heralded progressive police reforms. And with time, the changes started to stick in a department that has just years earlier seemed unfixable. The reforms produced real change in the statistics. The excessive use of force rates plummeted, the homicide rate decreased, and new incentives laid the groundwork for a completely new understanding of what it meant to be a good cop. You had to change the underlying principles of the way police officers were being trained and taught, and the culture in the department, said former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who supported the changes in Camden. The most effective way to do that was to start over. But nothing is as simple as it sounds in a tweet. While largely a success story, the overhaul was by no means a clear win for social justice progressives who are driving the police reform debate nationally. The Camden police reform was, and remains, politically divisive. In part, that was because union contracts were thrown out, leaving many on the force earning a lower salary with fewer benefits. And it required very strange bedfellows to succeed. An all-powerful Democratic machine, a Republican governor, conservative budget cutters, and progressive police thinkers all aligned to break an established department and start over. In 2010, Camden hit rock bottom. The city, population 77,000, was widely considered one of the most dangerous in America. A depopulated former manufacturing center across the Delaware River from Philadelphia, and the home of the first Campbell soup plant, the city had more than 3,000 abandoned buildings. Almost 40% of residents lived below the poverty line. At one point, the city had 175 open-air drug markets, and 80% of drug arrests were of non-residents, suggesting that out-of-towners were making a stop in Camden just to buy and sell. Violent crime had been high in the city for decades, but it was about to get worse because the police department was broke. In 2010, Camden, faced with a $14 million budget deficit, laid off half of its police force. Arrests in 2011 fell to almost half of what they had been just 2 years earlier, and burglaries increased by 65%. The murder rate skyrocketed. Eventually, residents largely gave up on calling police for minor crimes. On top of that, the police department had a reputation for bad cops. Of the 37 excessive use of force complaints levied in 2011, not one had been sustained or clearly proved or disproved, which raised serious red flags about accountability with the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union in New Jersey at the time. In 2010, five officers in the department were charged with evidence planting and fabrication, as well as perjury. Later, state and federal courts would go on to overturn the convictions of 88 people who had been arrested and charged by those officers. The idea for dissolving the Camden Police Force came against the backdrop of a push by both Governor Chris Christie and Democratic state lawmakers to regionalize city and town services in a new era of government austerity. State Senator Don Norcross, Camden County Freeholder Lou Capelli, and Mayor Dana Redd started promoting the idea of dissolving the Camden Police Force and creating a new county-led force to replace it. A state statute was already on the books allowing counties to create police departments that towns could then opt into. But the plan would also involve busting a union. Without the restrictions of the union, proponents argued, more cops could be put on the streets of Camden, and hopefully the city's deadly spiral could finally be stopped. In May 2013, the Camden City Council approved resolutions that eliminated City Police Department and established a new one under county control. The remaining city cops were all laid off and had to reapply to work with the county under far less generous non-union contracts. Those who championed the disbandment of the department say the upheaval was critical to the department's ultimate success. Scott Thompson, the Camden police chief at the time, had locked horns with the police union for years over contracts and virtually any type of managerial decision, he says. I was able to do in 3 days what would normally take me 3 years to do. All of the barriers were removed. I was now driving on a paved road. The most obvious change was that the Camden police force was now bigger. By cutting salaries, the county was able to hire more officers, increasing the size of the department from 250 to 400, and putting the number of Camden police officers close to what it was before the 2010 budget cuts. But the more important changes went beyond the size of the roster. Thompson, who had been appointed chief in 2008 and oversaw the department through the transition, also used the changes as a way to implement a number of progressive policies. The challenge, he said, was reframing how officers viewed their role. An officer would no longer be an arbitrary decider of what's right and wrong, he said, but rather a facilitator and a convener. The internal metric system for rating an officer's performance was also overhauled. No longer were officers rewarded for the number of tickets they had written or how many arrests they had made. Thompson says his highest priority was working to integrate officers into the fabric of the community. I don't want you to write tickets. I don't want you to lock anybody up. I'm dropping you off in this corner that has crime creates greater than that, that has crime rates greater than that of Juarez, Mexico. And for the next 12 hours, I don't want you to make an arrest unless it's for an extremely vile offense. Thompson recalls telling his officers, don't call us. We're not coming back to get you until the end of your shift. So if you got to go to the bathroom, you need to make a friend out there. You want to get something to eat? You better find who the good cook is. The changes were not without hurdles. In the first year of the new department, for instance, the number of excessive force complaints about the police spiked dramatically. But the department implemented a series of reforms to reduce conflict between officers and residents. Camden was chosen as one of seven cities by the Police Executive Research Forum, a reform think tank in Washington, D.C., to develop its signature de-escalation training, according to Executive Director Chuck Wexler. Camden soon had proof on video that the training worked in real life. Clips from surveillance and body cam footage in November 2015, which have since spread across YouTube, particularly in police reform circles, show a man walking into a fried chicken shop in Camden, knife in hand. He leaves the shop, thrashing the knife in the air, and is encircled by a group of officers. They walk with the man for several minutes, asking him to drop the knife. They attempt to tase the man and fail, but are ultimately able to tackle him. 18 months before that, we would have shot and killed that guy. Two steps out of the store, said Thompson, the former police chief. When former President Barack Obama visited the city back in 2015, he held up Camden's police department as a model for police reform. He called Camden a symbol of promise for the nation, praising the improved relations between officers and residents. This city is on to something, he said before a crowd of hundreds. But there are critics who think the reforms have not gone far enough. There are concerns that the department's force does not reflect the community. The department is just ever so slightly majority-minority. Camden is 93% minority, mostly Hispanic, 50.3%, with a large African-American population, 42.4%, according to the most recent census figures. But the police department is nearly half white. There is also high turnover in the police department, according to several people interviewed for this article. It's hard to say that things are changing when you're having a revolving door of officers coming in, said Kevin Barfield, president of the Camden County NAACP chapter. And a lot of them are young. A lot of them are not really familiar with the community with which they serve. On Sunday, a group of activists gathered in Camden to give voice to those concerns and let the public know that they hadn't gotten the full picture a week earlier. Hundreds of protesters walked the streets of the city in midday June sun, ending their march on the steps of Chief J. Scott Thompson Police Department building. President Obama tweeted out Camden has been the poster child for reform across the country. Active Ayen Merrill yelled to the crowd. Say no, he told a crowd of hundreds of Black Lives Matter protesters. No, the crowd protest responded in chorus. The tone of this gathering was markedly different from the one a week earlier. The participants in this protest spoke about the crooked cops and felt the viral photo was merely a feel-good photo op. As Merrill stood on the steps of the building, he called out for Police Chief Wysocki to stand beside him. We are going to hold everyone accountable. We have to stop being scared of authority figures and really hold them accountable, Merrill said, wearing a loose noose around his neck. He then presented the chief with a list of demands, including working to help officers eliminate racial bias in policing, the creation of an independent civilian review board, and recruiting a more diverse force. But what came next suggests why even their toughest critics feel like there is more hope in Camden than there is in other cities. We are going to give credit where credit is due. They said they are already starting to work on things we listed, Merrill said as he removed the rope from his neck. Today we are loosening this noose and taking it off. A version of this story originally appeared in Politico.com. We're on the Talking Points page with a story about a surprise Supreme Court decision. Gorsuch and Roberts, unlikely champions of gay rights. The Supreme Court delivered a landmark victory this week for the rights of gay and transgender Americans, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Until now, employees could be fired in 26 states for being gay, bisexual, or transgender. But Chief Justice John Roberts and President Trump's first appointee, Neil Gorsuch, joined the court's four liberals to rule that Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which bars discrimination, quote, because of sex, applies to LGBTQ people. When a man and woman are both attracted to men, but only the male employee is fired, Gorsuch wrote in the majority opinion, sex plays a necessary and undisguisable role in the decision, exactly what Title VII forbids. He said that when an employer fires a trans person, it's also for traits or actions connected to sex. Gorsuch and Roberts are not crusaders for equality, but they're smart enough to know when their party's position has become politically untenable. Polls show that an overwhelming majority of Americans oppose workplace discrimination against gays. There's a special sweetness in this 6-3 vote, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. The phrase, quote, but Gorsuch, is shortened for how conservatives justify all the moral compromises they've made in supporting Trump. Now Gorsuch has authored the most important gay rights decision since the court legalized gay marriage in 2015. I had much higher expectations for Gorsuch, said Ed Whelan in NationalReview.com. A replacement for the late conservative icon Antonin Scalia, Gorsuch, like Scalia, supposedly uses a textualist approach to interpret law. But Bostock versus Clayton County is a betrayal of textualism. As Justice Samuel Alito notes in his dissent, Gorsuch's opinion represents a judicial approach that Justice Scalia excoriated, the theory that courts should update old statutes so that they better reflect the current values of society. When Congress passed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, it certainly wasn't thinking about gender identity. This is not a narrow ruling, said Helen Andrews in the AmericanConservative.com, and by extending civil rights law to the LGBTQ spectrum, it opens Pandora's box. In fact, this ruling is the Roe v. Wade of religious liberty, said Josh Hammer in the New York Post. By using Title VII to override traditional religious values, Gorsuch and Roberts did what Democrats in Congress tried and failed to do for years. The tangible results will be harrowing. Can a Catholic school deny employment to a teacher whose sexual lifestyle blatantly flouts millennia of Catholic moral teaching? Can an Orthodox Jewish day school refuse to hire a male teacher who self-identifies as a woman? Clearly, the legal conservative movement has failed conservatives. Gorsuch is a product of the Federalist Society, which created a farm system of conservative legal thinkers trained to obsess over text and original intent, while ignoring the thorny moral questions posed by cases. The legal left triumphs by making forceful moral arguments about justice. The conservative movement must adopt that playbook. Otherwise, it deserves to perish. What flamboyant hysteria, said Tim Miller in the Bulwark.com. Hard as it may be to believe in 2020, There are still many gay, lesbian, and transgender Americans who have lost jobs, been forced to hide their sexuality or gender identity, or been discriminated against in their places of employment. What is the legal and moral basis for wanting that hurtful bigotry to continue? Religious conservatives are angry now because they sold their soul to Trump in hopes he'd appoint judges who'd fight the culture wars for them. They just want someone who is willing to vote with the team and justify it in whatever means necessary. The fight for LGBTQ equality isn't over, said Ian Millhiser in Vox.com. Days before the Bostock decision, the Trump administration finalized a regulation permitting health providers to discriminate against LGBTQ patients. Trump also opposes anti-discrimination protection for trans students and has fought to ban trans people from the military. Bostock could be transformative because interpreting sex to protect LGBTQ people will have the broad consequences. Still, the textualist approach of court conservatives has ominous implications for liberals, said Jessica Levinson in NBCNews.com. Roe v. Wade was decided on the basis of a right to privacy that Supreme Court justices interpreted the Constitution to provide. If Gorsuch and Roberts join the other three conservatives in deciding that the textual basis for Roe doesn't exist, social conservatives may get their biggest prize after all. And we'll end with a quick quote from Napoleon Bonaparte, who says, "In politics, stupidity is not a handicap." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138.